The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, continued on cassette number 4, side 1. If he were put in charge of the Congressional Campaign Committee, he could guarantee that it would have funds. He asked Sam Rayburn to put him in charge. Rayburn did not do so. The relationship between him and Lyndon Johnson during the year and a half following the July 1939 confrontation over the Texas delegation's resolution on the Garner-John L. Lewis explosion will probably never be charted definitively. Around the speaker's personal feelings had been erected a wall as impenetrable as the wall with which Lyndon Johnson surrounded himself. But there were hints as to its course. The confrontation itself had not angered him. If anything, he seemed rather proud of the way Lyndon had stood up to him. "Lyndon is a damned independent boy, independent as a hog on ice," he said when someone asked him about the incident. But despite Lyndon's attempts to conceal the fact that it was really he who was turning Roosevelt and the New Dealers against Rayburn, the majority leader may have realized at the last moment the role being played by this young man of whom he was so fond. On the very day on which his secret campaign to undermine Rayburn in Roosevelt's eyes had triumphed, on April 29, 1940, the day the president had forced the majority leader to accept as co-signer on the Harmony Telegram, Kid Congressman Lyndon Johnson, Johnson attempted to act as if no reason for a break between them existed. A Washington Post article stated that Johnson praised the work done by Rayburn in achieving the compromise, and predicted he would lead the Garner-pledged Texas delegation with other men of liberal makeup. A week later, he made a private overture. Rayburn's roommate during his first year in the Texas legislature, R. Bonner Ridgway, wrote Johnson a note advocating Rayburn's nomination as vice president at the upcoming Democratic National Convention, and recalling his roommate's character. "He was so quiet and reserved, honorable, honest, and 100% true to a friend." Johnson had not written to Rayburn for a year, since the time, in fact, that he had begun his career as the New Deal spy in Rayburn's meetings. Now, perhaps using the Ridgway note as an excuse to resume communications, he sent it to Rayburn with a covering note of his own. "Here is a letter from one of the rank-and-file boys whom I'm happy to know is a great admirer of yours. Signed, your friend Lyndon." Previously, when Johnson had written Rayburn, the majority leader's replies had been warm. The three lines of his reply to Johnson this time spoke volumes. "Thank you for sending me the letter from my old-time dear friend, Bonner Ridgway. With every good wish, I am sincerely yours, Sam Rayburn." As part of the compromise that had ended the Roosevelt-Garner fight in Texas, the White House had insisted that Johnson be made vice chairman of the state's delegation to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Rayburn was chairman, so at the convention the two men were frequently thrown together, and often heard together of candidates' financial problems. But when Johnson, who of course was himself unopposed for re-election, raised the possibility that the solution to the problems was his appointment as head of the Congressional Campaign Committee, Rayburn gave him no encouragement. Then Johnson attempted to gain a role in the financing of congressmen's campaigns by another method. He tried to become the liaison between the Congressional Committee and the Democratic National Committee, which furnished much of its funds. Rayburn was not amenable to this suggestion either. On August 20th, Rayburn told a Flynn aide that there would indeed be a congressional liaison man, but neither of the names he mentioned was that of Lyndon Johnson. "I think it will be John McCormick and probably Charlie West," he said. Johnson continued maneuvering. The young New Dealers who were his friends received from him continuing stories of the desperate straits of Democratic congressmen, of the likelihood that the Democrats would lose the House, of Drury's inefficiency, of Drury's lack of enthusiasm for the candidacies of New Deal congressmen. These stories were reported at the White House, along with Johnson's interest in being of help in an overall effort to elect Democratic congressmen, and the suggestion was made, according to some sources, by the President himself, that Johnson should in some vague way be attached to the Congressional Campaign Committee or to the Democratic National Committee itself to assist them. Johnson, however, appears to have had in mind not an assistantship, but independent formal authority of his own. His next attempt to get it may have been an attempt to circumvent Rayburn, an approach directly to the President through the malleable Agriculture Committee chairman Marvin Jones. On September 14th, Jones went to see Roosevelt and then sent a letter, drafted by Johnson, suggesting that if we are to get the results that we desire, Lyndon's work should be supplementary to the regular work done by both the Democratic Congressional Committee and the National Committee, rather than an assignment to aid them with their regular functions. A letter drafted by Johnson for Flynn's signature, to be sent out by Flynn to all Democratic members of the House of Representatives, further spelled out the authority he had in mind, and in addition included a reference to the President, which might have thrown the weight of at least a hint of presidential authority behind Johnson's efforts. Had Johnson's draft been sent out by Flynn, Flynn would have been saying, "Dear Congressman Blank, the President has discussed with me some of the problems you will face in November, and I have assured him that the Democratic National Committee will do everything possible to give you the maximum assistance in your coming campaign. In order that we may work most effectively with you in this connection, I have asked one of your Democratic colleagues in the House, Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas, to act as liaison officer between my office and the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic congressional candidates." This would, of course, have made Johnson the arm of the Democratic National Committee in dealing with congressmen. Roosevelt, however, did not want to give him such formal authority. He eliminated the reference to liaison officer. All the letter, as edited by Roosevelt, says is that in order that the Democratic National Committee may work most effectively with you in your campaign, Johnson will assist me, Flynn, and the Democratic National Committee in aiding the congressional candidates. Roosevelt told Johnson he would give the letter to Flynn and asked Flynn to see the young congressman. But Flynn balked at giving Johnson even the informal post. Meeting with Johnson in his room at the Carlton Hotel on September 19th, he said he would be glad to send out the letter if it met with Rayburn's approval. Rayburn's approval was not forthcoming. Then Johnson thought he saw an even better opening. On September 23rd, the National Committee Secretary, Chip Robert, resigned. Johnson pulled strings to obtain this post, using the argument that in it he could serve as a liaison with the Congressional Committee. Influential Democrats such as Claude Pepper, a Longleaf visitor, wrote or telephoned the White House to urge the appointment. Johnson persuaded Drury to write Roosevelt that he would have no objection to it. Roosevelt may have considered making it. The possibility was raised with Rayburn, who had become Speaker the week before, but Rayburn's response was that the appointment would be satisfactory to him if it was satisfactory to Flynn, which, of course, Rayburn knew it wasn't. Flynn, who had been less than enthusiastic about Johnson's appointment even to an informal liaison role with the committee, had stronger objections to his being made its secretary. He said, in fact, that if Johnson was appointed, he would resign. With or without formal appointment, Johnson saw no way around Flynn's opposition, particularly without Rayburn in his corner. He drafted a letter to Roosevelt saying that after discussing the matter of my participation in the congressional campaigns with Ed Flynn and several of my colleagues here on the Hill, I have come to the conclusion that because of the shortness of time and the possible resentment of such informal participation in the sphere of influence of well-established outfits, it would be inadvisable to make further attempts to work out the suggested arrangement with Mr. Flynn. He redrafted the letter before sending it to Roosevelt, in the reworking revealing some of his techniques, for the missive's five brief paragraphs contain subtle denigration of the work of the man he wanted to replace. "Certainly the job is there to be done. My own youth and inexperience may be an error, but I feel tonight that we do stand in danger in the lower house. Flattery. I know in your wisdom you will work it out." Subtle pointing out why he was well suited for the job. The campaign, he said, was effective in cities, but not in the 50% remaining, which, of course, was in rural areas such as the one he represented. And a personal touch, noting that we lost 82 seats in 1938, he said that the present 45 margin gives me the night sweats at 3 a.m. Despite the letter, Roosevelt would agree to Johnson's participation only on the original, very informal basis. The note from FDR to McIntyre on October 4th said, "In the morning, will you call up Congressman Lyndon Johnson and tell him that Flynn strongly recommends that we proceed on the original basis as worked out between him and Congressman Drury, which will give Johnson a chance at once to send out the letters which were agreed on, but which made no reference to the President, and that he should do this right away." Johnson, however, was still reluctant to accept so informal a role, particularly without Rayburn's support, and that support was still not forthcoming. But Sam Rayburn was becoming desperate. If the Democrats lost control of the House, he would lose the speakership he had just assumed after 28 years of waiting, and every indication was that they were going to lose. Since 1938, when the Republicans had almost doubled their House holding from 88 seats to 170, every special election necessitated by the death of a member had confirmed the trend toward the GOP. In 1940, the trend had been accelerating. In the 7 special elections held since the first of the year, the Republican share of the vote had risen an average of 6%. Democrats had hoped that that trend would be reversed in a presidential election year, but those hopes had been dealt a body blow just 3 days before Rayburn had become Speaker, for on September 13th, in congressional voting in Maine, the Democratic vote in the 3 main congressional districts was down by the same 6%. That 6% figure was especially ominous because, in 1938, no fewer than 100 of the 265 Democratic seats had been won by less than 6% of the vote. The Republicans needed to gain only 48 seats to take control of the House in 1940 and elect their own Speaker. Democrats and Republicans alike felt that the GOP would gain more than that number. Regardless of the outcome of the presidential election, the New York Herald Tribune reported on September 15, Republicans are confident and Democrats fearful that the next House of Representatives will be organized and controlled by the Republican Party for the first time in 10 years. Those who deal with figures cannot avoid the trend which set in the congressional elections of 1938 and its continuation in all congressional off-year elections since then. Democrats couldn't even get back home to campaign. Deepening crisis in Europe and the Far East, and the need for new crisis legislation, the Selective Service Act, funding for new military bases, forced Congress to remain in session all summer and into September. September drew to a close, and no major new legislation was before Congress, and the gleeful Republicans, backed by the press, in such a time of crisis, the institution through which the will of the American people is expressed ought not to leave Washington, editorialized the New York Times, insisted that it stay in session. As Arthur Kroc wrote on September 24th, "The Democratic House majority is in real danger, whoever may win the presidency. That is what is disturbing the Democratic members as the time of the session lengthens, and the Republicans, while equally anxious to campaign, count on that to keep the adjournment cake and eat it too. They would then go to the country, crying out against adjournment at such a time and making all the political hay which could be gathered in season." And into many of the Democratic members trapped in Washington poured reports that they were in trouble back home. The time was growing too short to repair the damage. Sam Rayburn had spent 28 years in Congress waiting to be Speaker. Was he to be Speaker for only 4 months? Over and over again, Rayburn was told that a principal reason for the impending electoral disaster was lack of money. Visiting the Chicago headquarters of the party's Midwest division, Charles Marsh reported that Chicago is a skeleton because no money has trickled from New York West yet. I walked through a graveyard with yawning offices everywhere. Apparently no money for payrolls, no definite amounts to make planning for radio and speakers bureau. Roosevelt's personal popularity would pull the president through, Marsh predicted, but it wouldn't pull enough congressmen with him. I believe the lower house of Congress may be lost by not getting money west now. And there was no money. In August, Rayburn had asked Flynn to set aside $100,000 to help congressional candidates. At the end of September, the Democratic National Committee had not contributed a penny. On October 2nd, a letter from Flynn's finance chairman, Wayne Johnson, must have made Rayburn realize how remote was the chance of significant financial assistance to his fellows from the DNC. Congressman William D. Byron of Maryland had made a personal trip to National Committee headquarters at the Biltmore to ask for financial help. Johnson wrote Rayburn, "Will you see what you can do to help Congressman Byron if his need is as acute as he thinks?" As for the National Committee, Wayne Johnson wrote, "We have had such difficulty in getting money to keep things running to date that I don't know how much we will have to help the Congressional Campaign Committee." Then, over the weekend beginning October 5th, premonition turned to panic. For on that weekend, Democrats, desperate over discouraging reports from their districts, began drifting away from Washington. By October 8th, when an informal recess was finally arranged, more than 100 members had already left for home on what the Times called French leave, and others, the Times reported, were threatening to quit the Capitol regardless of what the body decides to do about remaining in daily session. When they arrived back in their districts, they found that the reports were all too true. In district after district, Democratic congressmen who had won by comfortable margins in 1936 and by smaller margins in 1938 returned home in 1940 with less than a month to go before the election to find that they were behind and that their opponents' campaigns were well organized and well financed with plenty of help from Washington, while they were getting no help at all. Michigan's 16th congressional district, which included part of Detroit and adjoining Dearborn, site of a giant Ford Motor Company plant, had once been considered a safe Democratic district. Running for his third term in 1936, Congressman John Lisinski had polled 61% of the vote, defeating his Republican opponent by 21,000 votes. But in 1938, the margin had been reduced to 10,000, 55%. And in 1940, the Republican candidate in the Ford-dominated 16th was a Ford, Henry's cousin Robert. Arriving back in Dearborn to begin his campaign, Lisinski found hundreds of Robert Ford for Congress billboards and numerous other indications of unlimited financial backing, including no fewer than a dozen well-staffed campaign headquarters. Clearly, the district wasn't safe any longer. It contained voters of 58 nationalities, so literature printed in foreign languages was a necessity. In the 1936 and 1938 elections, the Democratic National Committee had sent truckloads of foreign language pamphlets to the district, 100,000 in Polish alone. Now Lisinski was informed that not one piece of foreign language literature had been received in the district. When he telephoned the Biltmore to find out when some would be arriving, he could not even get through to anyone who could give him a reply. Compiling a detailed list of the minimum needed, 50,000 pamphlets in Polish, 5,000 each in Hungarian, Ukrainian, Italian, and Russian, he telegraphed it to the Biltmore, and this time he got a reply. The pamphlets had been set in type, he was told, but there was no money available to print them. And he couldn't get campaign buttons. He pleaded for a visit by Roosevelt to his district, reminding Washington of the great crowds the president had drawn in Detroit in 1936, but he couldn't get Roosevelt. That was understandable and standard for any campaign. Every congressman wanted a popular president in his district. But Lisinski couldn't even get a picture of Roosevelt. So few posters of the president were available that they were framed under glass to preserve them and carried from one rally to another. Not one could be spared, Lisinski was to write, to hang in his own headquarters. Lisinski knew he was in trouble. He needed all the help he could get. And he couldn't even get a poster. Lisinski's experience was being repeated, that first part of October, in scores of congressional districts. In 1940, radio was still not the most expensive campaign item for congressmen. Most spent more money on billboards. "When you saw a lot of billboards for your opponent," recalls a man who ran many congressional campaigns in the pre-war era, "you knew that he must have a well-financed campaign in other areas, too." Now, in district after district, the congressman arrived home to find his opponent's face staring down at him from billboards, and to realize what that meant. And when he wrote or telephoned his congressional campaign committee for help, he found that not only cash, but the most basic types of other campaign materials were difficult to obtain. In previous elections, the committee had relayed requests for buttons, posters, bumper stickers, literature, nationally prominent speakers, to the parent Democratic National Committee, and Farley's efficient staff, sympathetic to congressmen and experienced in solving their problems, had done their best to meet their requests. Now, with Farley and his staff abruptly gone, and with Farley's replacement, Flynn, interested almost exclusively in Roosevelt's election, the National Committee, its resources more limited than ever, was all but ignoring congressmen's requests. Overshadowing every other problem for the returning congressman was their shortage of campaign funds. Lisinski had pleaded with Drury for help. What he received was a check for $100, a very small amount of ammunition with which to fight a Ford. That was not an ungenerous contribution by Drury's standards, particularly given the state of the Congressional Committee's bank account. The long-awaited subvention from the Democratic National Committee finally arrived on October 10th. It was not the $100,000 for which Rayburn had asked, but $10,000. Parceled out among 78 candidates in contributions of $1 or $200, it was an amount too small to make a difference in the fight on which hung Sam Rayburn's fate. Not since the New Deal had swept into office in 1932 had Democratic candidates for Congress needed more help, and instead they were getting less help. Tallying the frantic telephone calls from the congressmen, Democratic congressional leaders realized that the fight was being lost. With Roosevelt's once substantial lead slipping back week by week until Gallup polls in early October showed Wilkie pulling into a virtual dead heat, the outlook for the House worsened. "You could have cut the gloom around Democratic congressional headquarters with a knife," Pearson and Allen were to recall. The campaign committee, headed by Representative Pat Drury, a charming and dawdling Virginian, had collapsed like the minister's one-horse shay. Activity had so bogged down that hard-pressed candidates had quit even asking for help. For the Republicans, it looked like a lead pipe cinch to regain control of the House. Sam Rayburn realized the situation, and if he didn't, a letter misdirected to Congressional Committee Secretary Cap Harding would have helped him realize it by giving him additional evidence of the financial odds against House Democrats. Contributions to the Republican Party from A. Felix DuPont, Jr. and his wife Lydia had been delivered to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee by mistake. The checks were for $3,000 and $4,000 respectively, and they were from just two DuPonts. No fewer than 46 DuPonts were active Republican contributors. Apparently still unwilling to put Lyndon Johnson in charge of the congressional effort, Rayburn now tried frantically to find someone else, but no one else wanted the job, recalls one of Rayburn's aides. It appeared that the Democrats were going to lose the House. No one wanted to risk his political future by being congressional campaign manager for the House. Rayburn talked to two or three other people, but found nobody available. Earlier in October, he told Roosevelt what he had told Flynn, that if the House were lost, even though he was reelected, it would tear him to pieces just like it did President Wilson after the Republicans won the House in 1918. He asked Roosevelt to appoint Johnson to the post he wanted, Chip Roberts' now vacant National Committee secretaryship. Flynn again refused to accept that appointment, but Johnson now agreed to accept the informal role with the Congressional Committee that he had earlier refused. Apparently changing his mind yet again, Flynn appears to have demurred even at this, but on October 13th, Rayburn begged Roosevelt to get Johnson into the congressional campaign in some capacity, formal or informal, and to do it fast. The president agreed to do so. He reportedly said, "Tell Lyndon to see me tomorrow." Lyndon saw the president the next day, October 14th, at breakfast, and that afternoon not only Flynn but Drury sent out the letters that assigned Johnson a role in the campaign. The role could hardly have been more informal. Drury's letter said only that Johnson would assist the congressional committee. No specific position or title was mentioned. While the role may have been informal, however, it was a role not on the district level or the state level, but on the national level. Rushing out of the White House, Lyndon Johnson placed a call to Houston, to Brown and Root. Chapter 32, The Muncie Building. The great political fundraisers, the Tommy Corcorans of Washington, the Ed Clarks of Texas, agree that most businessmen who contribute to political campaigns don't contribute enough to accomplish their purposes. They want ambassadorships or contracts or input into policy, but they don't give enough to get what they want. Their contributions are grudging or slow in coming, or too small to place the recipients under sufficient obligation to them. "There's always just a few," says Clark, "only the most sophisticated and the smartest, who give real money, and who give it eagerly enough and early enough so that they can reap the maximum return on their investment." Herman Brown, on top of whose native shrewdness had been overlaid the sophistication obtained from more than a decade of involvement in the financing of state politics and politicians, was one of the few. "When Herman gave," says Ed Clark, "he gave his full weight." When Johnson's call reached Brown and Root headquarters, the response was immediate. Since the Federal Corrupt Practices Act prohibited political contributions by corporations, money could not come directly from Brown and Root. Because of a $5,000 limit on an individual's contribution to a political organization during any one year, not enough of it could come from Herman or from his brother George. Therefore, Herman arranged to have six business associates, subcontractors, attorneys, his insurance broker, send money in their names to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And Herman acted fast. Johnson had made his telephone call on Monday, October 14th. On Saturday, October 19th, George Brown telegraphed Johnson, "You were supposed to have checks by Friday. Hope they arrived in due form and on time." Johnson was able to reply by return wire, "All of the folks you talked to have been heard from. Many, many thanks. I'm not acknowledging their letters, so be sure to tell all these fellows that their letters have been received." The amount of each check was the maximum contribution allowed under the law, $5,000. The initial Brown and Root contribution to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was $30,000, more money than the committee had received from the Democratic National Committee, which had in previous years been its major source of funds. Nor was this the only money Lyndon Johnson received from Texas during his first week on the new job, for he had persuaded Sam Rayburn to make some telephone calls to Fort Worth and Dallas, and to stop talking in terms of hundreds. On October 14th, Sid Richardson, through his nephew, Perry R. Bass, sent $5,000. On October 16th, C.W. Murchison sent $5,000. And another $5,000 arrived from Charles Marsh's partner, E.S. Fentress. By Saturday, October 19th, Johnson was able to bring to the offices of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, to be distributed to Democratic candidates for Congress, a total of $45,000. 1 week after he had taken his job, he was able to write Rayburn aide Swager Shirley, "We have sent them more money in the last 3 days than congressmen have received from any committee in the last 8 years." One talent that Lyndon Johnson had already displayed in abundance was ingenuity in political tactics. Now he displayed it again. By saying in his letter to the candidates that Johnson was only assisting the Congressional Campaign Committee, Drury had thought he was keeping Johnson subordinate to the committee. All these first checks from Texas, of course, were made out to the committee. Johnson had to turn them over to the committee for deposit in the committee's bank account, and it was on this account that the checks for contributions to individual candidates were drawn. They were signed by the committee's chairman, Drury, and mailed out, with an accompanying letter by Drury, from the committee's office in the National Press Building, in the same manner as any other contributions, with no indication that the money that had made them possible had come from Texas, or that it had been raised by the efforts of Lyndon Johnson. For a man who had pulled political strings to get a dam legalized, authorized, and enlarged, Johnson's method of letting the candidates know that he, not the committee, deserved the credit for the contributions, was relatively simple, but ingenious nonetheless. He had had George Brown instruct each of the Brown and Root contributors, and apparently had had Rayburn instruct Richardson and Murchison, to send with their contributions a letter stating, "I am enclosing herewith my check for $5,000 payable to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. I would like for this money to be expended in connection with the campaign of Democratic candidates for Congress, as per the list attached to the individual named in the amount specified." Johnson had, of course, compiled the list, and had determined the amount each of the lucky candidates was to receive. Since the committee would hardly dare to disobey such specific instructions from the donors, it was Johnson rather than Drury or Harding, or anyone else, who was determining who would get the Texas money and how much. And armed with this knowledge, he had no sooner left the committee headquarters, having handed in his checks, then he sent to each of the recipients the following telegram, which made it abundantly clear to each recipient who was really responsible for the check which he would be receiving from the Congressional Committee the next day. "As result my visit to Congressional Committee few minutes ago, you should receive airmail special delivery letter from them which is to be mailed tonight." Of the elements in Lyndon Johnson's career, none had been more striking than his energy. Procuring checks wasn't all that he did that first week. Permission to assist the Congressional Campaign Committee had finally been given to him on October 14th. Election day was November 5th. He had 3 weeks. Within 3 hours, he had rented an office, furnished it, and filled it with a staff. Herbert Henderson, John Connolly, and Dorothy Nichols from his congressional office. Only Walter Jenkins was left behind to keep that office open. The furnishings of the room in the five-room suite that would be his private office revealed a distaste for the Spartan. The furniture rental order read, "One large executive desk, one swivel desk chair, two armchairs, one club chair, one divan." That same day, he composed a questionnaire to be sent to congressional colleagues. 1938 votes received? Is your present opponent stronger than your 1938 opponent? Describe briefly type of campaign he is making and principal issues he is raising. Where can you or a representative be reached at all times in your district? And dictated to be sent with the questionnaire a letter announcing his entrance into the campaign. Although he was ostensibly assisting Drury's committee, the office he had taken was in another building, the 11-story Muncie Building at 1329 E Street Northwest, off Pennsylvania Avenue, away from Drury's eyes and supervision. He had done more that busy Monday. The letter and questionnaire were not sent to all his colleagues. Conferring over the telephone with Rayburn, McCormick, and with Paul Appleby, campaign manager for vice presidential nominee Henry A. Wallace, and a politician with a detailed knowledge of the political situation in Midwest congressional districts, he had selected from the 435 Democratic candidates for Congress several score who should be helped. His decision was based in part on which districts had had the closest results in 1938, but only in part. One of several lists hurriedly compiled by Henderson and Connolly was titled, "The following men received a majority of more than 10,000 over their Republican opponents in 1938. Democrats had considered these seats safe, but only because they had not done a thorough analysis. Johnson did one, analyzing not merely the vote totals and percentages, but the type of district, and found that many of them were in danger, and these congressmen were selected for assistance." By the end of the first week in his new assignment, he had further refined his lists. One refinement was caused by John L. Lewis. The coal miner's chief was turning against Roosevelt. Although speculation was rife about the effect of his defection on the presidential race, no one was thinking about its effect on congressional candidates. Johnson assigned his staff to draw up a list of districts which produce 1 million tons or more coal, and of the 1938 congressional results in those districts. Then, sitting down with a yellow legal pad, he went to work on the list himself. 15 districts in 6 states were involved. In 1938, Democrats had won all of them. Calculating the margin in each district, he added them up and divided by 15, and around this average he drew a circle in red, and drew a red arrow to it, for the average was only 8,268. Then he calculated the Democratic percentage of the vote in each district, carrying the long division out to several places, and the percentages confirmed the bad news. The 15 districts could not be considered safely Democratic this year. Their Democratic congressmen needed help, too. Other lists were compiled, by him personally, no aide was allowed to do this, compiled with the same painstaking thoroughness, if you do absolutely everything. He also called a luncheon meeting in a private room at the nearby Hotel Washington. Present were Rayburn, McCormick, Appleby, Alvin Wirtz, and 3 White House aides, Lowell Mellett, Wayne Coy, and Jim Rowe. James Forrestal was invited but was unable to attend. At this meeting, the lists were further refined, so that when, that first week, the money from Texas having arrived, he began distributing it, the identity of the 77 recipients had been determined by a rather intensive analysis, the type of analysis that for years had been routine for the Republican Congressional Committee, but rare for the Democrats, and that had not been made at all in 1940. On the questionnaire Johnson had sent out, candidates had been asked to list suggestions as to how, in your opinion, we can be most helpful. Underneath had been left 3 blank lines, marked 1, 2, and 3. Many of the respondents, of course, asked for a visit to their district by the president, but that was not the reply most frequently made on the first line. The most typical reply was that of Representative Martin F. Smith of the state of Washington's 3rd Congressional District. Financially. Representative John F. Hunter of Ohio's 9th Congressional District was firmer. One was financial assistance, he wrote. There is no two. Others wrote a line or two of elaboration. The best service that you could possibly render me would be to arrange a campaign contribution of $200 or $300, said Wendell Lund of Michigan's 11th Congressional District. The thing this district needs most of all is money, said George M. May of Pennsylvania's 10th. And some, as though the mails were not fast enough, made the same point over the phone, says an interoffice memorandum. Robert Seacrest, of Ohio's 15th, called and talked with John Connolly, said the only help he needed was a little money. Candidates who had dealt with the Congressional Campaign Committee in the past had little hope that they would get what they asked for. Seacrest wrote on his questionnaire, "Nothing will help except cash, and I know that is scarce." Lawrence F. Arnold of Illinois's 23rd noted that he had received $200 from the committee in 1936, but nothing in 1938. He had asked for $200 this year, he noted, and had not received even the courtesy of a reply. Emmett O'Neill of Kentucky's 3rd wrote, I feel sure that there is nothing that can be done to help. He needed money, he said, but I know money is not floating around, so this is not meant as an indirect solicitation. But to their astonishment, their hopes were answered. Four-term Congressman Martin F. Smith had returned home to find that there was a good chance he wouldn't be reelected to a fifth. He had stayed in the Capitol until October 8th, and he had stayed too long. Stepping off the train after the three-day trip home, he was promptly informed by campaign aides that he was in serious danger of losing his seat. His only hope was to increase his planned advertising in his district's 42 newspapers and to reserve radio time, and he didn't have enough money to do either. He left for a week-long tour of the district with no money in sight. And then, when he checked in with his campaign headquarters in Hoquiam one evening, Johnson's telegram was read to him. Naturally, he hoped that the Congressional Committee's airmail special delivery letter to which the telegram referred would contain funds. Arriving back in Hoquiam several days later, he found on his desk not one but two letters from the committee. Ripping them open, he found in each a check. One for $200, one for $500. Arriving weary at a hotel one evening, Representative Charles F. McLaughlin telephoned his headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska, and was told that a telegram had been received from Lyndon Johnson. When he reached Omaha the next day, the airmail special delivery letter to which it referred was already there, and it contained a check for $300. All across the United States, similar scenes were enacted. Slumping into a chair in a hotel room or lying on the bed, shoes still on, too tired to take them off after a long day of campaigning and worrying about campaign funds, a congressman would telephone his headquarters, would be read Lyndon Johnson's telegram, and would realize that funds were on the way. Others got the news in their campaign headquarters. Representative Edward V. M. Isaac arrived home in San Diego to find, as he wrote Johnson, his opponent's face staring down at him from hundreds of billboards. He had no billboards, and he found, to his dismay, no organization. Thousands of copies of a hard-hitting pamphlet selling the Roosevelt-Wallace-Isaac ticket had been printed in an attractive red, white, and blue color scheme, but there was no money to mail them to voters, and without an organization, no other way to distribute them. Most canvassers who would distribute them door-to-door wanted to be paid for their work, and even volunteers required reimbursement for lunch money, car fare, gasoline, and other expenses. And then the telegram arrived from his colleague from Texas, the telegram and then a check for $500. With it, he could pay the necessary expense money to get the pamphlets distributed. And hardly had the workers fanned out from headquarters to, as he put it, carry the Roosevelt-Wallace-Isaac story from door to door, when another letter arrived, with another $500. Others got the news at home. Nan Wood Honeyman had been campaigning in Portland for months, but was making no headway. Largely, she felt, because Sam Rayburn had not been able to deliver on the commitment she believed he had made to her at the Democratic Convention in July. Receiving Johnson's questionnaire, she had responded with a telephone call on October 17th, and John Connolly's memo for LBJ, summarizing the call, Connolly may have been taking shorthand notes on an extension, began, "In your conversation of yesterday with Nan Wood Honeyman, she pointed out the following things which would be helpful to her. 1. Finances. Mrs. Honeyman had asked that contributions be sent to her at her house, and the next day there arrived at 1728 Southwest Prospect Drive the telegram, "As result my visit to Congressional Committee, you should receive." The first letter from the committee contained the pre-Johnson contribution, $150. She thought that was the airmail special delivery letter to which Johnson had been referring. She was appreciative, but $150 wasn't going to help much. Her opponent was on the way home, she wrote, and had sent word to raise an extra $1,500 for him right away, in spite of the fact that his literature covers the city. He has been on the radio from Washington once or twice a week for some time, and his face and "One Good Turn Deserves Another" on huge billboards meets me at every turn. Then, on October 19th, the Johnson contribution, $500, arrived. "Received 5-point program today," she wired back in jubilation. And they were very grateful. The text of your thoughtful and kind telegram had been read to me over long-distance telephone, so that on my return from a thorough tour of 4 counties of my district, I today found 2 airmail letters, Martin Smith wrote Johnson. "I appreciate your personal efforts in my behalf." McLaughlin said simply, "I'm glad you are where you are." When the first $500 arrived from Johnson, Isaac had dashed off a letter, "Thanks a million." And before that letter could even be dropped in the mail, he had to add, "P.S., your airmail letter of the 19th, the letter which contained another $500, just arrived. Again, many thanks." "Dear Lyndon," Nan Honeyman wrote, "I have been on the verge of calling you all day instead of writing because it is such fun to hear you. The second contribution from the National Committee arrived on the heels of the first one, and the raise of the ante was grand, and I know my gratitude belongs to you." They were to become more grateful, for Lyndon had only begun raising money. Some he obtained through personal acquaintance. Tom Corcoran, in New York, raising money for Roosevelt, arranged for some cash contributions from garment center unions, which he brought to Washington himself and gave to Johnson, as Corcoran was to relate. Another union with political money to spend was the United Mine Workers. John L. Lewis might be for Wilkie, but did the UMW really want a Republican Congress? UMW Chief Counsel Welly Hopkins recalls that he hadn't been in place with the Congressional Campaign Committee more than 24 hours when he called me and said he wanted to see what the mine workers could do toward helping the campaign. Hopkins presented Johnson's case to the union secretary-treasurer, Tom Kennedy. Johnson went to see Kennedy and, Hopkins says, "I think he went away satisfied as far as the responses that the mine workers made." Money from New York came not only from 7th Avenue, but from Wall Street. $7,500 arriving from the investment banker brothers Paul and Cornelius Shields through the offices of the wealthy New Yorkers he had met through Ed Weissel. Some he obtained because of his ability to arouse paternal fondness in older, powerful, wealthy men. Charles Marsh did not even have to be asked. No sooner had he learned of Johnson's assignment to save Congress for the Democrats than, busy though he was working on the Wallace campaign, he volunteered at once the two commodities with which he was so free, advice and money. Recalls Alice Glass's sister, Mary Louise, Marsh's private secretary. Charles said to him, "Boy, you've got to get some money. You can't do that on goodwill." Contacting four business associates in Texas, Marsh arranged that each would give him $1,000 per week until the campaign ended, and that he would add to their contributions $1,000 per week of his own, and forward each week a total of $5,000 to Johnson. "I had to keep track of who paid," she says. Allowing Marsh to know that other men were similarly helping his protege might have dulled the edge of his enthusiasm for the task, so this information was not given to him. So fast did the money come in that Johnson was able to broaden his assistance. Martin Smith had been so thrilled to receive the Congressional Committee's checks for $200 and $500. Before the week was out, he would receive a second $500 check. A filled-in questionnaire and letter requesting financial help arrived from Representative William H. Sutpin of New Jersey on October 17th. Johnson dictated a reply saying, "I'm going to make an especial effort to find some way to get you some financial assistance." But before he had had a chance to sign and mail the letter, the influx of funds had enabled him to be more specific. On the bottom, he added a postscript. "Today I'm asking a Texas friend of mine to give me $500 for you. If he does, I'll take it to the Congressional Committee and ask them to rush it to you tonight." Actually, Johnson had either the money or the assurance of it in hand when he wrote that, and the $500 was sent that night. He had so much money, in fact, that he was not only meeting requests for funds, but soliciting more requests, asking congressmen to ask for money. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.